Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. As storms brew at home, an on message President Trump is overseas. He's redefining U.S. objectives in the Middle East. In Saudi Arabia, he made clear the U.S. wants Muslim allies to step up their fight against terrorism and also their investments in the U.S. In return, he won't tell them how to run their countries. Today, he's in Israel visiting the Western Wall, and he'll face more tests as he meets with Palestinian leaders, the Pope, and NATO. This hour on Point, President Trump's first foreign trip and his message to the world. You can join us on air or online. What did you think of President Trump's speech in Saudi Arabia? Do you agree with his message and his choice to back off criticism of their human rights record? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Washington is Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael, hi, welcome back to On Point, and did I get your last name right?
Of course you did, and thank you, Jessica. Great to be here.
It's so good to be with you. I always mangle your last name. Okay, also in Washington, Shadi Hamid, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the author of the book Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. Shadi, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to you. So, gentlemen, there's been a lot of trouble at home for President Trump, but he seems to be getting good reviews so far for his first big trip abroad. Michael, let me start with you. Set the scene. He gave a major speech in Saudi Arabia this weekend in front of Muslim allies after an exceptionally warm reception. Everyone wanted this to go well, did it?
I think it did, by most measures, at least in terms of sort of stagecraft and discipline, staying on message, not offending anyone, accomplishing what the president wanted to accomplish. Now, there will be a lot of critics of the substance and the underlying message, and we can talk more about that. But I think that, you know, Trump satisfied his own goals, which was that he, you know, gave, I guess the bar is not that high to give a speech that someone puts in a teleprompter and you read off. But with Donald Trump, anything is possible. He gave a smooth speech. The visit generally seemed to be a logistical success. He was warmly welcomed. There were no gaffes or flaps before or after the speech. All the visuals were of a good relationship with Saudi Arabia, which is what Trump was trying to telegraph. And I think that even Trump critics on the left who were appalled by the way he talked about Islam and Muslims and the Middle East as a candidate have to breathe a sigh of relief here, however they may feel about Trump generally. And, you know, at least see the glass as a quarter full, which is to say that, you know, there's an American president who many people thought was going to kind of plunge us into all kinds of chaos and anarchy, and particularly when it came to the Muslim world and the Middle East, was going to say incredibly inflammatory, offensive things that would whip up anti-American hatred. And in fact, Trump went and gave, you know, a relatively, I would say actually, a mainstream moderate speech in which he emphasized that the U.S. is not at war with Islam, did not use language that I think most people would consider to be bigoted or inflammatory, and really spoke in a voice not that different from what I would call the, you know, Washington foreign policy establishment, that dreaded thing that Trump ran against. So we can talk more about it, but I think on those tests he passed.
Okay, let's pause and listen to some of the change in tone. I'm going to let us hear some of Donald Trump speaking first in March 2016 while he was still campaigning. This was his tone on Islam then.
I think Islam hates us. There's something There's something there that there's a tremendous hatred there. There's a tremendous hatred. We have to get to the bottom of it. There is an unbelievable hatred of us.
And then this was Trump this past weekend in that speech in Saudi Arabia. Note his different tone on the religion.
This is not a battle between different faiths, different sects, or different civilizations. This is a battle between barbaric criminals who seek to obliterate human life and decent people, all in the name of religion. People that want to protect life and want to protect their religion. This is a battle between good and evil.
Shadi Hamid, what's your reaction to the new tone we heard from President Trump in this speech?
Well, I went in with very low expectations, perhaps similar to Michael. I mean, here in some ways is our first openly Islamophobic president, someone who had said endlessly disparaging comments about Muslims during the campaign. And it's kind of, he did actually say, I think Islam hates us, as we just listened when he was a candidate. So for him to have this striking imagery of the Quran being recited in what was the birthplace of Islam, in Saudi Arabia, I mean, that was a very different vibe than I think a lot of us were used to in thinking about Trump and his relationship to Islam. So the expectations were very low, and he cleared them. That said, it was a satisfactory speech, but not a great one. There wasn't anything particularly interesting or original or groundbreaking in the speech. And, you know, for a speech that was almost obsessively focused on confronting extremism, there was very little about how to actually confront extremism. So on a substantive level, a lot was lacking. But I don't think any of us were going into this thinking that there would be a great strategy or a great vision about how to actually improve things in the Middle East. And, you know, speaking as someone who studies Islam and politics, but also is an American Muslim, I think a lot of us in the Muslim community were very concerned that, you know, what if he keeps on saying things that are offensive to Muslims or Islam? So I think, you know, in some ways, I'll take what I can get. He didn't say anything terribly offensive about Muslims.
So he cleared very low expectations, is your takeaway. I'm curious, you know, the real substance of his speech effectively focused on turning to the countries that were there and saying, it's your job to do more to fight terrorism in your borders. But in return, he pivoted away from the past two presidents in that he didn't call for careful attention to their human rights violations. And he also singled out Iran as the single greatest bad actor in the region and a shared enemy. Hamid, was this, in a sense, pandering to his audience?
He was pandering to his audience. I mean, here are largely a bunch of autocratic leaders who have really bad human rights records. I think, so he said, we will not lecture you. We will not impose our values and that sort of thing. And that would normally be a welcome line. The U.S. shouldn't go around, forcing people to be something they're not. But that said, when it comes from Trump, it means something very clear. It means Trump is not going to even bring up human rights concerns in his relationship with the Saudi regime or the Egyptian regime. And I think that's very problematic. But that's part of the transactional relationship that I think Donald Trump is going to be prioritizing. He's essentially saying to the Saudi leadership, I'm not going to bother you about human rights or women's rights or whatever. And in exchange, I'm going to ask you to do a little bit more on confronting extremism, on tightening terrorist financing and things of that nature, but also to invest in the U.S. and to buy more U.S. weapons systems. So I think that's the kind of transactional relationship that Trump is going for. And that's something that the Saudis respond well to. And let's also remember that the Saudis and many Arab leaders had a really, in some ways, a visceral dislike for Barack Obama. And for them, that was the ultimate low point And pretty much anyone, if we found Bob down the street in Virginia, that would be a major improvement compared to Barack Obama from their perspective. So, you know, again, Trump isn't just having to clear the low expectations that he himself set. He's clearing the low expectations because he's coming after Barack Obama, and that's someone the Saudis very much did not like.
Michael, let me raise with you something that Shadi just pointed out. There was a major announcement of a Saudi purchase of U.S. weapons and an announcement that the Saudis would also invest billions of dollars in American infrastructure. So in a way, one could see this as sort of selling to the U.S. this investment in return for us averting our eyes on human rights abuses. Is there another way to read this?
Well, yes, I think so, which is to say it's basically business as usual, particularly when it comes to arms sales. The U.S. has been selling billions and billions of dollars of military hardware to these politically repressive Gulf Arab monarchies for many years now. Now, that dollar figure, I think, is unusually high. I don't know if it's unprecedented. So a Trump person might retort that this is a deal on a larger scale. But, you know, we were already talking tens of billions of dollars in arms sales to other countries in the region. The infrastructure investment, let's see, you know, we've had some quote unquote investments from other countries announced under Trump so far. And when people went and looked at the details, they said that there was a little less than meets the eye to them. But look, I think at least as a matter of what Trump wants us to understand about it, it's that this is the kind of transactional nature of Trump foreign policy, which is to say, you know, Trump basically sees us in the world as, number one, needing to protect ourselves, and number two, not get ripped off and get as much money out of other countries as possible. So as Shadi laid out, you know, human rights and democracy and all those things are well and good, but they take a much lower priority. And I think the message that Trump wants people to take away from that arms deal and the infrastructure investment is that we're doing business with other countries, we're getting money out of them, and, you know, as Trump would put it, we're not getting ripped off anymore.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about President Trump's first foreign trip. The president delivered a highly anticipated speech about Islam in Saudi Arabia yesterday, and he visited the Western Wall in Jerusalem today. You can join the conversation. What do you hope the president accomplishes during his overseas trip? What's at stake? I'm talking with Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. And with us from Washington is Shadi Hamid, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the book Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. And joining the conversation now from New York is Michael Wilner, Washington bureau chief and White House correspondent for The Jerusalem Post. Michael Wilner, welcome back to On Point.
My pleasure.
I'm going to ask all of you to stand by as we take a moment to listen to some of what both Benjamin Netanyahu said, the Prime Minister of Israel, as he greeted President Trump earlier.
We've already made peace with Egypt and with Jordan, and Israel's hand is extended to peace, in peace, to all our neighbors, including the Palestinians. The peace we seek is a genuine and durable one, in which the Jewish state is recognized, security remains in Israel's hands, and the conflict ends once and for all.
And here is what President Trump said when he touched down on the tarmac at Ben Gurion Airport.
We love Israel. We respect Israel. And I send your people the warmest greetings from your friend and ally, all of the people in the United States of America. We are with you. Thank you, and God bless you. Thank you.
Michael Wilner, this is supposed to be the easy stop of the trip. Good relations all around. That was the expectation. Will it turn out that way?
You're absolutely right that it was supposed to be the easy stop. I would say that leading up to the trip, there were some issues. Obviously, the apparent slippage in the Oval Office of President Trump, letting the Russians in on highly classified Israeli intelligence, did not go over well in Israel. You had controversy over how the president would visit the Western Wall, who he would visit with. He did not allow Israeli officials to join him, saying that he wanted to keep in the spirit, the religious spirit of the site, but that was controversial at home. You had controversy over whether or not he was going to deliver an address at Masada or the Israel Museum. The Israelis obviously were highly anticipating this trip, and every single moment is being carefully watched, both by the Israelis and the Palestinians. Naming disputes were something of an issue. His staff was calling Bethlehem part of Palestine, whether or not that was some sort of indication that they view the West Bank to be a sovereign territory controlled by Palestine was confusing. So he's getting a sense of how difficult it is to actually get into the details of this conflict, which he's obviously sought to avoid. He's tried to relegate all of those details to his chief negotiator Jason Greenblatt and to his son-in-law Jared Kushner, but the more he gets involved in this portfolio, the more he's going to learn that the devil is in the details.
Shadi, I mean, this is the story of Israeli Palestinian Middle Eastern conflict. The devil is in the details. Is it surprising to you that a new administration would walk into so many unforced errors, or is that sort of standard at the beginning?
The devil is in the details, but Trump doesn't really care so much about the details of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So he's coming in from the get-go and talking about making the ultimate deal and saying very optimistic things about resolving a conflict that no one's been able to resolve thus far. There's something sort of endearing in a kind of naive way about that, that he doesn't seem to realize how large the gap is between the Israelis and the Palestinians, you know, especially under someone like Netanyahu, who isn't going to give a lot of ground. So, but at the same time, the fact that he doesn't seem to care so much about saying offensive things or crossing certain red lines. So you almost wonder, the fact that Trump is coming at this with, to some extent, a blank slate, does that empower him to push where other presidents have not been able to push before? Obama was always concerned about seeming anti-Israel because a lot of Israelis thought he was anti-Israel. That kind of charge doesn't stick as much with Donald Trump for a variety of reasons. So I wonder if that gives him a little bit more freedom. Of course, that's my glass half full interpretation. We'll have to wait and see. But, you know, I think Trump is taking on a lot by offering this optimistic language, and maybe he'll be disappointed quite soon.
Let's see what some of you are thinking. We'll take a call now from Marshall, who's calling in from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Marshall. Marshall, what's your comment? No, sounds like we've lost him. We'll come back to our next caller. But Michael Crowley, let me ask you, do we expect anything substantive to come out of this trip? We heard that he plans to make the ultimate deal. Will he take steps in that direction?
I think not. It depends on how you want to define substance. I think the substance here would be the first inklings of a new process, the seeds of a new round of peace talks. Some people have raised the possibility, you know, Trump is, of course, meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He will also meet with the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. some people have raised the possibility that there could be some surprise joint meeting of the three of them together, which might signal some willingness to resume a conversation that has been dormant since John Kerry abandoned his last peace push in around this time in 2014, I believe it was. But, you know, even that would be procedural. I think that on the substance, we won't hear much at all. No one is really looking to make policy here. I think the symbolism of the trip, particularly for Trump and the Israelis, is the thing. And to, you know, if anything, to try to sweep bad symbolism or bad vibes under the rug in terms of the leak in the Oval Office that Michael described, and I think some ambiguity and possible frustration on the part of the Israelis about where Trump stands exactly on Israeli settlement policy. But I just don't think that's going to be cleared up. And again, it will be more processes type stuff if there's anything. But I expect mostly it's symbolism everyone wants here.
Let's try the phones again. We're going to take a call now from Nancy, who's calling in from New York. Hi, Nancy. What's your comment?
I'm just calling to say I think it's outrageous that the president is not emphasizing human rights to these dictators and other problematic governments that he's meeting with. This is what makes our country exceptional. You're constantly hearing Republicans talk about American exceptionalism. Well, I don't understand the concept if it doesn't involve fighting for human rights.
Thank you for the call. Michael Wilner, what is the calculus here in the president, in this administration, to de-emphasize the call for human rights?
My understanding is that they are simply prioritizing security cooperation, and they feel as if discussing human rights in private somehow will be more effective. They speak about how their private discussions with the Egyptians, for example, have made more progress in, as they say, in a few short months than Barack Obama had in several years of public lecturing. Whether or not that's the case is obviously debatable, but that's the case that they're making, that that these Arab governments don't appreciate being publicly lectured. It's ineffective. And even though, of course, it's consistent with American values to make such public calls, the goal is the results, and we haven't seen much progress in this region towards the advancement of women's rights, obviously gay rights, or name it, in the past 8 years. So that, I think that's the argument that they're making internally. And obviously the president has been accused of not caring particularly about this issue. And he obviously has prioritized, again, security cooperation, military cooperation, and intelligence cooperation. And that was the forefront of his speech. And as many people have noted, his speech was focused on counterterrorism 8 years ago when Barack Obama made his inaugural speech to the Muslim world in 2009. Terrorism wasn't mentioned once. So I think it's just a tactical difference, and you could debate whether or not one is effective for the other.
Jessica, can I jump in really quick?
Please.
Because I wrote a story about this a week or so ago, which was focused on the idea that human rights activists in the U.S. and in other countries, members of Congress, are growing concerned that the Trump's dismissal of human rights, and also, as his critics put it, his sort of disregard for traditional institutions, rule of law, assaults on the media, violating political norms, to take one example, accusing his predecessor of wiretapping him based on no evidence. All these things not only are undermining America's image abroad, but actually potentially giving fodder to anti-democratic rulers around the world to clamp down harder. That human rights activists in other countries say that, you know, if even America can't set a great example, how can they make an argument for change within their own country? There's a couple examples, including one in Cambodia, where journalists were threatened with expulsion from the country by the government. And the government in Cambodia was arguing that Donald Trump has called these news outlets fake news. Everyone knows they're fake news. And so we're entitled to throw them out. There are a few other points on that list. that there's not time for now. But the point is, Jessica, that people are concerned that this is not only, in their view, kind of surrendering a piece of American values that make us feel good about ourselves and as part of an important American project around the world, but might be doing real harm around the world, setting a terrible example and already giving license to other governments to change their behavior, not only by letting them off the hook, but in some cases, if Donald Trump is setting an example with his own behavior, to let other countries basically emulate it.
And a real shift from two prior presidents. Let's take a call now. Hal is calling in from Austin, Texas. Hi, Hal. What's your comment?
Hi, Jessica. Well, I'm somewhat concerned about security in the Middle East if Donald Trump is giving a $100 billion plus arms deal to the Saudis on the heels of Barack Obama's $38 billion gift of arms to Israel. And this puts a lot of pressure on the Iranians who've been who've just now elected to support their more moderate president over the weekend. It seems now that the Iranians have agreed to suspend their nuclear program that we're adding a lot of concern and anxiety for those people that their sworn enemies are getting huge gifts of armaments from the United States. So this big deal that Donald Trump has done, which puts a huge infusion into the military-industrial complex here in the United States, seems to be spreading anxiety.
Thank you, Hal. Let me put this one to you, Shadi. Would you walk us through both the impact of this arms sale on Yemen in the region, what's happening with Saudi Arabia and Yemen, and also what the caller mentioned about the new focus on Iran? How could that actually inflame tensions in the region?
So, you know, if I had to sum up Trump, the part of the Trump doctrine, it would be dictators are the solution, and that means arming and supporting authoritarian regimes. And that leads to problems like this, like some that we see in Yemen. And Yemen doesn't get a lot of attention, but the Saudis have been involved in a really problematic and destructive intervention there. It's led to a humanitarian catastrophe. And one of the concerns about arming the Saudis to the teeth is that they are misusing U.S. weapons systems in a way that doesn't respect civilian life in Yemen. And Trump thus far has been much more indulgent of the Saudi intervention there. And that's a big concern. And in terms of arming all these different regimes, is that ultimately going to lead to a more peaceful Middle East in the long run? And let's also remember that authoritarian regimes do contribute to some of the root causes, if you will, of extremism. They don't give their citizens a stake in the democratic process. Citizens don't feel like they have a way to express their grievances. So this, it's not just that it's bad from a moral perspective. It's also bad from a national interest perspective. That's obviously not the way the Trump administration sees it. But this is not just about promoting our values. It's about also looking at what contributes to extremism in the long run. And if we go back to George W. Bush, so some people have said this speech was reminiscent of George W. Bush. I couldn't disagree more. George W. Bush had emphasized what he called the freedom agenda. And his argument, for better or worse, was that the only way to fight extremism and terrorism in the long run is to promote democracy and human rights, because that's the only way to promote a more peaceful Middle East as part of a broader strategy. Trump has really moved away, not just from Obama, but also from George W. Bush in that respect.
Michael Wilner, what will success on this trip, on this leg of the trip, the Israel leg, look like?
not anybody off.
Has he done so far?
So far, so good. It's a very visual trip, obviously. His appearance at the Western Wall is a is a powerful moment for any president. First of all, this is the first sitting president to visit the wall. For the wall to be cleared and for him to place a prayer. I will say it's a dangerous thing to do, because when Barack Obama, as a candidate in 2008, placed a prayer in the Western Wall, somebody took it out. Somebody found the prayer and published it. And so if you're talking about potential pitfalls, I assume he was careful with what he wrote, because 'cause that may end up public.
Michael Wilner, thanks so much for joining us. Shadi Hamid, thanks to you as well. And we're discussing President Trump's first overseas trip. Next, we'll look ahead to his meeting with NATO leaders and his visit with Pope Francis. I'm Jessica Yellen, and this is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about President Trump's first overseas trip. You can join the conversation. How's the trip going so far? What do you hope to see as President Trump meets with Pope Francis, European leaders, or NATO officials? My guest is Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. And with me now from Berlin, Germany, is Christine Berzina, a transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund, who focuses on EU-US relations, NATO, and transatlantic security. Christine, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So I am looking right now on my laptop at a headline that says NATO chief denies saying President Trump has a 12-second attention span. These are the headlines leading up to the president's arrival in Europe. What are we to expect from this powwow?
People in Brussels are very anxiously awaiting Thursday's visit. And like what we heard just now about the expectations for his trip to Saudi Arabia or Israel, the anticipation is that something could go wrong, and so everyone is waiting with bated breath for there not to be any news. If the outcome of a meeting in Brussels is a series of handshakes between Trump and his partners within NATO or within the European Union, and a few smiles, and that's all we get out of it, I think there will be a breath of relief, because there is such fear that a stray tweet or an exhausted president could do something that would undermine the transatlantic alliance.
So let's hearken back for a moment to the campaign and remember how then-candidate Trump viewed NATO. This is a comment he made in an interview on CNN in March of 2016.
Do you think the United States needs to rethink U.S. involvement in NATO?
Yes, because it's costing us too much money. And frankly, they have to put up more money. They're going to have to put some up also. We're paying disproportionately. It's too much. And frankly, it's a different world than it was when we originally conceived of the idea and everybody got together.
So how do you expect his tone to be different when he meets with NATO allies? And what substantively could come out of that?
The quote we just heard and President Trump's fear that the U.S. has a bad deal in NATO is well understood among all the NATO allies. The difference between the time of that quote and today is that there is a lot of attention and effort being made among all the NATO allies to really pay their fair share. Only Germany has publicly spoken out against the need to pay for 2% of GDP towards defense budgets. And that really is more a question of accounting and what is a defense budget and what isn't a defense budget. So NATO has been trying very carefully to orchestrate the Thursday meeting in order to show President Trump that progress is being made on his priority on defense spending and on equal sharing, and also to discuss President Trump's second pet issue, which is counterterrorism. When we look at that, it seems that the meeting could go off very well. You mentioned the 12-second quote. The meeting should be shorter than usual. NATO is a very large organization, 28 allies. Each of the allies' heads of state are able to give their thoughts. President Trump, given that this is the second last-to-last stop on his foreign trip, probably will be feeling very tired. Brussels wants to show him a warm welcome and also to make sure that he doesn't get too tired and impatient with all of the proceedings. So a snappy meeting addressing his main concerns is what we hope to get out of it.
Michael, a member of the Trump staff has already said that he's exhausted.
Yeah, which was disturbing to say the least, given that he, at the time of that quote, he had four more countries and dozens of leader interactions to go. He has got a lot of work yet to do. And a lot of his critics pounced on that quote because Trump, of course, was pretty merciless as a candidate about his opponent's energy levels. Jeb Bush was famously very low energy. Hillary Clinton, according to Trump, lacked the stamina to be president. So let's see if that was, a slip of the tongue or, you know, how accurate it was. But if Trump is not able to soldier through and deliver a pretty high energy performance, I think he's going to have some explaining to do. Not that he is one to apologize. But look, this would be a test even for, I think, you know, John Kerry, for instance, who had spent, you know, many years working in the world of international relations and foreign affairs and was an incredibly high energy guy, also ran for president. This would be a test for someone like him. The number of countries, the number of leaders, the number of issues, the opportunities for a slip up or a gaffe. So it will be amazing if Trump makes it all the way through without tripping over his shoelaces. We'll have to see.
It is a grueling schedule. And so far, he has stayed on message. I'm going to read a comment from a listener. John Richt writes in, I admit to being a strong critic of the current president. I also admit the optics of this trip appear to be good. The current administration is faring better than I expected over the last 2 days. That's on the optics. There's going to be another challenge ahead, Michael, when the president meets with the Pope. To me, this is in some ways the most fascinating part of the trip because they were so highly critical of one another publicly, yeah, which is deeply unusual for a Pope to get this so, as involved as he did in presidential politics and for a president to criticize a Pope. Let's just first, before we discuss this, listen to President Trump speaking to reporters on May 18th. Talking about this Pope.
For a religious leader to question a person's faith is disgraceful. I'm proud to be a Christian, and as president, I will not allow Christianity to be consistently attacked and weakened, unlike what is happening now with our current president. Okay? Believe me. No leader, very important, and this has just been given out to the press 2 seconds ago, no leader, especially a religious leader, should have the right to question another man's religion or faith.
So Donald Trump, they're defending himself against criticism by the Pope. And then this was Pope Francis speaking to reporters and explaining that his upcoming conversation with President Trump will, from his point of view, focus on peace. And he said he will not judge the president or his policies before he meets him. Here's a little bit. He's saying, I never make a judgment about a person without hearing them out. I don't think I should do that. During our talks, things will come out. I will say what I think, and he will say what he thinks. But I have never, never wanted to judge a person before hearing what they have to say. That said, Michael, do you expect that when they're privately meeting one-on-one, the Pope will not criticize the president, his policies on the environment or on immigration?
I think it's quite likely that the Pope will, you know, in a kind of gentle, non-confrontational way, make his, you know, reiterate his views on those issues. Immigration is another important one. The Pope, I believe that was the subject of the fight during the campaign. Fight might be a strong word, but the back and forth, Trump's rhetoric about Mexican and Muslim immigrants. By the way, hearing that quote from the campaign really takes me back because I remember that was one of those days where everyone was saying, well, he can't get away with this. This is the end for Donald Trump because you can't pick a fight with the Pope and win it. And he soldiered on and didn't seem to suffer much damage. So he it was one of those moments where he seemed kind of invincible. But the tone, as it has on so many fronts, has clearly changed on Trump's part. I think Trump will be extremely deferential and respectful. I think Trump recognizes that, you know, his religious conservatives in the United States and Catholics were really important to his election and is not looking for any kind of a controversial story. I think his stop at the Vatican, is really designed, again, to be symbolic, to show him as a leader on the world stage, mingling with the most powerful and revered people on earth. And I don't think it's in his interest to have any kind of controversy. I think it's quite possible that behind closed doors, the Pope will make disagreements known. But I don't think the Pope is looking for anything confrontational either.
Christine, when it comes to leaders in Europe, are they paying attention to the turmoil at home? And do Trump's challenges, his domestic challenges, impact his chances to have some success in his meetings with the NATO leaders?
Everybody in Europe is paying attention to Donald Trump. I don't think he can escape the scandal in Washington, whether he comes to Brussels or whether he winds up on a Pacific island. Cell phones still buzz with pop-up alerts with the latest controversy out of D.C. So, of course, there's full awareness in Europe right now about scandals surrounding Russia and with investigations, the FBI. The full thing really is on the agenda of all the other political leaders. Will this come up in the meetings with NATO, in the bilateral meetings between Donald Trump and the European Council and Commission presidents? I doubt it. The purpose of this meeting in Brussels is optical. It's shaking hands, putting names to faces, and to breathing more life into the transatlantic institutions. In Brussels, President Trump is going to help unveil a monument to 9/11. He is going to help open the new NATO headquarters. It is a symbolic moment to show transatlantic cooperation. Barring any missteps, this should be a pretty simple message and a pretty simple goal to achieve.
You know, we have to recall that Donald Trump not only was critical of NATO, but he backed Brexit. He invited Nigel Farage, the great EU critic, to the U.S. I imagine there is some degree of not just anxiety, but real hostility among some of these nations toward Trump and the message that he has advocated. What do Europeans want out of the experience?
Europeans are becoming a little bit impatient with Donald Trump. Initially, there was shock that a presidential candidate could say these things, could speak out against the European Union and its deep ties to the United States. There was great worry immediately after the inauguration when the rhetoric didn't immediately change in Washington. And still, there was a sense that President Trump would promote other Brexits and that President Trump was going to back Marine Le Pen in the French election, officially, unofficially, but that his heart was with her rather than with the other candidates. Now, there is maybe less patience overall for having to respond to every new tidbit that comes out of Washington. And so President Trump will have to be a bit careful to be respectful of the European leaders while he is here. They have started to fire back on the Brexit point. Commission President Juncker, in a couple of months ago, said that if President Trump was going to continue to back the dissolution of the European Union, that Juncker would be backing the exit of Texas or Ohio from the United States, that this game can go both ways. And Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council, has even called President Trump one of the four major threats for the European Union. So when he's going to go into these meetings, he has to take into account that the people across the table from him can fire back. And right. If the U.S. is interested in security, if the U.S. is interested in the trade that it has with its European allies, he's going to have to play nice.
Let's go to the phones. Katie is calling in from Chicago, Illinois. Katie, hi. What's your comment?
Hi, Jessica. I'm calling about the optics of the first 2 days of the trip, which I found very offensive. He is with an autocratic royal family that is living a very ritzy, glitzy, expensive lifestyle. He's being played up to and given, you know, awards. And I found it very offensive. And in a way, it makes me think that this is what he thought the presidency was going to be, because I think this is what he does think the presidency is going to be. So it's very offensive. His family is very involved in all of this and in ways that remind me that he thinks he is part of a royal family.
Thank you, Katie. Michael, let me use this as an opportunity to ask you about Ivanka Trump, who sat with Saudi royals and gracious and thanked them for a $100 million gift they made to a fund for women's empowerment and congratulated them on the good work they're doing to empower women in Saudi Arabia. This was not met with cheers by many women's groups in the U.S.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on the caller's point, certainly that is, you know, the Saudis have a sense of decor and architecture that is Trumpian, and he probably felt not so out of place if you've seen pictures of his apartment in Trump Tower in particular. But Ivanka Trump really did give the Saudis some PR that they desperately want. You know, they understand that one of the, you know, if you ask people about women in Saudi Arabia, I think people would know, most people who know anything would say, you know, they have to cover up. They can't go out without male escorts and they can't drive cars, you know, that sort of thing. And the Saudi government has been slowly working to change that, but the progress is very slow because of the power of the religious establishment there. And I think that people felt like Ivanka Trump, you know, oversold the rate of change there and did a disservice to Saudi women who are not being empowered as quickly as many activists would like them to be. And you know, I think that you could argue that that is a peril of somebody who doesn't really know anything about the country coming in, making a declaration, has a huge platform. Obviously, you know, her Twitter account and the media attention she gets, you know, broadcasts that message louder than anything the Saudi government could do on its own. But she comes in with basically no context, and that's I think a reasonable cause for concern.
And Michael, in the last 30 seconds, I just want you to answer, if you could, briefly: will a successful foreign trip ameliorate Donald Trump's domestic problems when he gets home?
You know, you hate to say yes, because this is all stagecraft and pictures, basically, and the substance of the Russia investigation hasn't changed and it goes on. I think as a reality, the way the media works, yes, this will be helpful for him. If he can stay on message, people will say he had a good trip, and boy, maybe he is, you know, prepared to handle this part of the job of being president, which is being a foreign diplomat and an emissary to the outside world without embarrassing us or causing big controversies. So yeah, that will have been a success, but the investigation goes on. He can't make that go away.
Thank you so much, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Wonderful to be with you. And Christine Berzina, a transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund, who joined us via Skype. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. And coming up on Point, while the president is overseas, his budget proposal back home slashes more than $800 billion for Medicaid. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.